Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to part two of our discussion of Hugh Nibley's life and legacy. This is the second section, which I mentioned earlier would be on his scholarship, especially the specifics of the types of things that he explored in his ancient studies work. We talked in the first section about, you know, all the languages he spoke and the different sort of things that even from a young age he's, you know, reading Old English and he's teaching himself languages and all those different things. But we want to look at, especially at a scholarship, briefly just about his non-Mormon related stuff. But then mostly the things that he put into service with the church, the kinds of articles he was writing for the Improvement Era, and sort of this public intellectual, public defender of the faith role. And we've got some great folks to deal with this with us. So we're welcoming back Boyd Peterson. Boyd, you're the biography of Hugh Nibley. What else would you like to say to our audience who may be just picking this one as their first burst on it?
So I did the biography, as you mentioned, of Hugh Nibley. I'm married to his youngest daughter, and that's kind of how I became interested in the topic. I didn't really know who he was when I got married, and people started asking me questions about him, and so I started having to do some research to answer, and one thing led to another, and I started getting into his life story, and so I did the biography, Hugh Nibley, A Consecrated Life. I think the copyright date's 2002, but it really came out the first part of 2003, I believe. And I currently
won a bunch of awards.
It got the biography award from MHA, and it seemed to be pretty well received. Hugh actually read it, and the praise I got from him was that he only complained about the fact that I misspelled a Latin patristic philosopher.
So oh, nice.
I felt like I was okay if that was the biggest problem he saw. So.
Great. And I interrupted you there for a second. You're about to talk about your work at UVU and what are you doing?
I teach at UVU in the English department, and I'm the program coordinator for Mormon studies there. So I get to do all the Mormon studies events.
Nice. Thank you so much, brother. Great to have you back for this second segment. Brian Hauglid, we'd love to meet you. You and I just met about a month ago for the first time, and after knowing a bit about you ahead of time, and we're just thrilled that you're joining us. Would you give us your bona fides?
I am a professor at BYU in the religion department. I teach in ancient scripture. Woo-hoo. And I'm also I just was appointed the director of the Willis Center at the Maxwell Institute as well. So I've kind of got a 60% with Maxwell and 40% with the ancient scripture.
And okay. So, and what is the Willis Center? Is that just a subset, apparently?
It's kind of a subset of the Maxwell Institute. It's independently funded, and it's the long name is the Laura F. Willis Center for Book of Mormon Studies. So it's focused on the Book of Mormon, but also other scriptures as well. And so, like I say, it's an endowed center, and hopefully it's going to be the premier center for Book of Mormon studies someday.
Nice.
And it also has the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies as part of its, it's a periodical. So, and I'm sure you probably are aware of that periodical.
Sure,
thing.
Sure.
So, and I'll talk more about my, you know, introduction to Nibley a little bit later, but it goes pretty far back. So
nice, good. Oh, can't wait to have all that you'll share with us. Kevin Barney, thank you for joining us. You have a wonderful, well, I'm aware of you as the Nibley guy because I actually, did I commission you or how did it come about that you wrote the really nice sort of in memoriam piece that we published in Sunstone upon Hugh's death?
I think you did commission me, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, I know we at least invited you somehow, and or somehow or other you just emerged from the pack very early, and I just loved it. I reread that today and really appreciated your neat words. Go ahead.
I just had an occasion to reread it, too, because on a Facebook group, and Dan, you were talking about how a lot of these young people probably didn't really encounter Hugh. And there was a young woman on one of the Facebook groups who was asking about Hugh Nibley and obviously had no idea who he was, but she had heard his name. And so I had occasion to recommend very, very highly Boyd's biography. But since it was an online forum, I also threw on there a link to the Sunstone in Memoriam piece that I did. And so we had a nice little discussion. This was just, I think it was just today, or maybe it was yesterday.
Wow.
About online.
Neat. Well, tell us a little bit more about, I know you're an attorney, but certainly you travel in lots of different circles. Tell us about your vocation as well as your avocations.
Sure. You know, professionally, I am a lawyer. I practice public finance law in Chicago, which has to do with the issuance of taxes on bonds. So I'm not an academic, you know, like Boyd or Brian are, but I am kind of a frustrated academic, and so I as an avocation, I do pursue Mormon scholarship as kind of a hobby,
and you do great work, brother.
So yeah, I studied ancient languages at BYU before I went to law school, and that was in large measure, you know, based on Hugh's influence. So we'll get into that more later, but Hugh Nibley was a large influence on what I studied and my approach and that sort of thing.
Neat. And again, your own encounters. I know you started reading him on your mission and all that stuff. So we'll just look for stories and turning points and those various types of things as we go. So thank you for being here. Well, let's just do this. Boyd, I'm going to throw to you first to just simply, review just 2 minutes worth of, you know, the different languages he spoke and sort of just the basics of his scholarly interests. So let's just kind of get an educational bit out here, and then we'll really focus in on the content of the types of arguments that he would make and the parallels that he would find and why those were, you know, a thirsty audience ate those up kind of thing.
So Hugh, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, Hugh had a very early interest in languages. He had an English teacher that really inspired him, and they memorized large passages of Shakespeare and other classic works, and that really got him on this trail of to keep going in languages, and he studied Greek and Latin, and then went on to Hebrew, and then he ended up at Berkeley, did his PhD at Berkeley in history and graduated from there, and then taught at Claremont, the consortium of colleges at Claremont, Pomona and Claremont Graduate School and Scripps, and he taught there until the war, and then ended up at BYU. So, you know, he published quite a bit very early on in very scholarly journals. 1942, his first piece was New Light on Scaliger in Classical Journal. Another one in Classical Journal in 45 after the war. Another one, then they published quite a few in Western Political Quarterly and then into Western Speech. He did a piece on the rise of rhetoric and the decline of everything else that ended up getting him a sabbatical at Berkeley. A Christian Envy of the Temple, which he published in Jewish Quarterly. Jewish Quarterly Review continued that. Passing of the Church, 40 Variations on an Unpopular Theme in Church History. One of his last pieces in a secular place was a piece in the Encyclopedia Judaica. But, you know, he had a long history, pretty decent vita of publishing in secular top-tier journals back in the early 40s from the 40s into the, you know, into the last pieces were in the 60s. So
okay. That went to academic journals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
No point about that time period.
Yeah, and somewhere, maybe it was in your piece, Kevin, or at least in one of the reflections, he like said that he never really had anything turned down by any academic journal, so obviously he was doing good work, right? Kevin, am I remembering that right?
Yeah, you're remembering that correctly. That was a snippet from his intellectual autobiography where, you know, he sent a bunch of stuff off to these academic journals, and they all got accepted, and he kind of lost interest a little bit because it really wasn't, you know, what he wanted to do. He didn't want to just pile up a big bibliography to stand at attention when he died.
Right.
He wanted to have an impact on people's lives, and so he kind of shifted course a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And we had talked in the earlier segment about just this mystical side of Hugh, this deep sense of spirituality, you know, kind of probably mostly inspired through his grandmother, his maternal grandmother. But then it kind of just was always underneath him. And it was either you, Kevin, or somebody else that I read recently that he kind of looked upon when he started to switch to Mormonism as kind of a consecration of his talents.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was a point I made in the In Memoriam piece, but and I do think I did use that word consecration, and of course that ties in with the title of Boyd's
consecrated life. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, so Boyd. So let's just say that, yeah, so he had the chops, the academic chops. He could have published forever on just ancient world, you know, minutiae, and, you know, certainly he was bringing some of those titles that you gave us. There was clearly a theoretical edge to them. He was trying to draw, you know, points and make larger sweeping statements and things like that. But you say he lost interest in the 60s, pretty much turned his attention to the ancient world, or at least those parts of the ancient world that maybe the Book of Mormon is said to be set within, those parts of the ancient world that kind of deal with the biblical and you know, Judaic world and things, right?
Yeah, and you know, I should back up. I mean, I think even his earlier work, even though it was published in secular journals, often he was speaking on two levels, and they often had Mormon subtexts. So if a Mormon would read some of these articles, Christian Envy of the Temple, for example, Jewish Quarterly Review, a Mormon would pick up a very different message from that than the non-Mormon audience. So the chops were there for the secular audience, but you know, his interest, I think, from the beginning was in Mormonism and in religion and in establishing those truth claims of the church. So, you know, in some ways it really wasn't a shift in focus so much as a shift in publication venues.
Okay, good. Yeah, neat. Now, Brian, this is a surprise question to you, and so we'll cut it out if this doesn't work on something you can comment on. In the biography segment of the podcast, Boyd kind of mentioned that until Hugh, in the late 40s and the 50s, kind of stepped up to the plate, there wasn't that much interest in the Book of Mormon. There wasn't much discussion at all in the wider Mormon stuff about Book of Mormon claims. Yeah, it was a book of scripture, but it really wasn't overly cited, focused upon, stuff like that. Is there something, can you flesh that out at all?
Well, you can certainly go back to B.H. Roberts. He certainly did some things with the Book of Mormon.
Right, but that's a good point.
But up to that point, where you're getting closer to the 40s and 50s, there's really not as much as that was going on earlier. What I see kind of happening is with Nibley is that Nibley, he wanted to take the Book of Mormon, and I think he was, and Boyd, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was somewhat sensitive to the attacks that were taking place against the Book of Mormon. And so he came up with a brilliant imperative to place the Book of Mormon in its attested self-attested ancient setting. And then let's see what happens. Is it going to fit? Is it not going to fit? What are we going to see come out of studies that, if you go back to 600 BC or whatever, are they going to support or not the Book of Mormon itself? And I see, to me, that was a brilliant way to kind of go about it, to put it right back in the setting it says it comes from.
Okay, and we'd probably have the archaeologists already going to South America, Central America, looking for the archaeological thing, right? But he was the one that kind of pushed it into the, well, let's just look at the ancient world in general and see what the little clues that are sort of in between the lines of the text are hinting at.
Noel Reynolds published an article in BYU Studies that really documents this thing you're talking about, that how in the first half of the 20th century, interest in the Book of Mormon had really waned. And it might be hard for people, students at BYU, to believe now, you know, there was no Book of Mormon class
right.
in the religion of BYU. It just wasn't done. And so this thing that Brian's talking about, where Hugh takes the Book of Mormon and takes it in a completely different direction, just treating it like he would any other ancient book, and treating it that way, it was brilliant. And all of a sudden, people are starting to get excited about it again. And, you know, in a way, he was following in Sidney Sperry's footsteps, who did something similar. But Hugh was just much more talented at it. I mean, Sperry was fine, but Hugh was like an artist with this stuff. And he caught people's imagination with it, and all of a sudden, people are becoming interested again in the Book of Mormon, where they had not been before.
Awesome.
Brian, I think it was fascinating that, for instance, Lehi in the desert, me as a, you know, my graduate studies were in Arabic and Islamic studies. And so when I first read that as a grad student, with my new Arabic kind of worldview of things, and he's going through and looking at these desert customs and these kinds of things. And I was like, wow, this is incredible that he's able to connect this so in such a fascinating way to the desert Arabs. And he was really right on in a lot of ways in what he was doing there, in Arabs naming things, for instance, going out into the, you know, and saying that, I can't remember which one, Laman or Lemuel, being as firm as this.
The Valley of Lemuel, I think it was. Yeah.
Something like that. And that's what Arabs did. You know, that was their thing, to do those kinds of things. And he was just really good. I mean, he was so perceptive, and it was he was just amazing in my mind. That's what made him so brilliant over Sperry, for me anyway, was he was able to go into the languages, the culture, it wasn't so much archaeology. I don't think he was quite as interested in that, but the culture and the language and those kinds of things was astounding. What he did with that.
Very good. So, Boyd, I kind of interrupted the narrative here a little bit to kind of capture that point that you'd mentioned in passing in the earlier segment. So Book of Mormon became one of his major publishing areas. When did, let's just name the others. So, for instance, another one is certainly the Book of Abraham. When did that come up to talk about and share about?
That was fairly late. That's like in the 60s. During the 50s, you had this slew of articles coming out about the Book of Mormon. I think 54, we had KSL. They do this kind of music and the spoken word thing. Hugh did a thing on KSL called "Time Vindicates the Prophets," where he was looking at ancient Christianity and the concept of a great apostasy, and so he was really interested in that for a long time.
Okay, good.
In fact, J. Reuben Clark proposed to him the idea that we should create a Mormon translation of the scriptures, which is kind of a fascinating thing, considering that Clark ended up being the guy who advocated the King James Version.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that there's a group that's really working towards that.
Yeah, there's a group at BYU that's doing that.
On their own, not like a church-directed thing?
Yeah, no, it's not a church-directed thing.
Okay.
And the first volume, electronically, is out by Richard Draper and Michael Rhodes on Revelation. But there's sensitivity about calling it a new translation, I think partly because of what Boyd was saying about J. Reuben Clark. So they'll have the King James Version in one column and then their translation in another column, but they call it a rendition.
Okay.
So they don't use the word translation because it's a very sensitive thing.
Right, good.
But yeah, you're right. There is a group at BYU doing that.
Okay, so that was just a total little sidebar. Brian, did you have anything more just to add on that? I wanted you guys to know, even though as I'm talking to Boyd here and say, what are the different subject areas, we'll definitely go back to the Book of Mormon. We'll go into depth about the arguments. So I don't want you guys to think we'll miss out by moving so fastly through kind of an overview. But go ahead, Brian. Thanks.
Yeah. I was just going to say that I am aware of that project, and I have not yet looked at that first volume. It sounds like Kevin has. I've only heard a few things about it, pro and con, I guess I should say. Some people are rather happy about it, and others are not. But I am aware of that. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. So Boyd, now we have a Book of Mormon one. You're kind of sticking with chronology. So patristics, early Christianity, the nature of those first few centuries in which Mormons typically would say this is when the apostasy happened.
Yeah. And then Hugh had he'd actually done some work in Egyptian early. He was never an Egyptologist, and he would never have claimed to be an Egyptologist, but he had done work in Egypt, in Egyptian, and even before the war, he had started studying that. But it wasn't until just before the papyri were discovered that he was given a sabbatical, and he ended up going back to the University of Chicago and studying with, he had planned to study with Wilson, I forget his first name, John Wilson, I believe?
John Wilson.
So Wilson took an early retirement, I guess, and so he ended up studying with a very new student, a new teacher named Klaus Baer at the University of Chicago, and spent the semester there, or the year there, studying Egyptian, and that was just prior to the papyri coming out. So he had, he was never an Egyptologist, and he would never have claimed to have been. But that became an increasing interest of his, and so Book of Abraham occupied a good share of his interest through the 60s into the 70s. And then temple research, the origins of the temple endowment, that became a real focus for him as well. And he spent a good share, especially in the 70s, and into the 80s, that was something he spent a lot of time on. So those were kind of the main areas of focus off the top of my head that he spent a great deal of time, in terms of his scholarship.
Right. And then you mentioned, his friendships and his deep interest in Hopi and Native American sort of spirituality. And would you ever say that was an academic interest, or is that just purely in the experiential realm?
Well, I think it was an academic interest. I actually got to, when I started working on the biography and I had moved back to Utah, I thought, gee, it would be great to have been able to go back and visit the Hopi. And a couple of weeks later, my brother-in-law called me and said, look, there's a chance we could go back. Do you think we could put together a group and go visit the Hopi? And so we worked it out, and I was able to go down and do that. And while I was there, it was really interesting because Hugh was very actively interested in the experiential nature of this this ritual, but he was throughout doing the same kind of parallels. Here's where they're doing the same thing that they would have done in Greece, and you would have seen the same kind of ritual at this point, and the Egyptians did this part, and so he was constantly showing how these things fit together into a broader picture. And, of course, for Hugh, one of the things I think gets lost when people start bringing up the issue of parallelomania is that during that period of time, parallelism was a very common part of the tradition in religious studies. Mircea Eliade was also at the University of Chicago. You know, he was very interested in looking at parallels in different cultures and looking at the patterns in religion. And so this was not an uncommon approach. And in some ways, Hugh was ahead of some of these other people at the time. Now, you know, later, and we, you know, Kevin and Brian can address this issue of the parallels. You know, later on, Eliade's work and Joseph Campbell, you know, the popularizer of that kind of work, people criticize that for being, you know, losing the particulars in terms of the parallel, you know, and drawing the parallels, we're losing the particulars. But that was a very common approach during the time. One of the differences, though, with Hugh is that he, of course, thought that this traced back to an original religion that had been, you know, placed on the earth and given by God, and that remnants had filtered down into different traditions. And so that was the explanation for, you know, why these patterns continued today.
And I do want to have a theoretical discussion about that. Can we hold off, though, a bit till later? Because I think that's important, but I don't want it to like color the rest of what we do in terms of just like laying stuff out. So okay, but thank you for that, because you're absolutely right. You know, that's the place I want to go for sure. Okay, so the Hopi maybe would be a fifth area. Kevin or Brian, any other like lines of inquiry that strike you that we haven't mentioned so far? At least just to name them.
Well, he did have some specifically apologetic works that he did.
Okay, so yeah, no ma'am and all that stuff, uh-huh.
No ma'am, that's not history, the Mythmakers, Sounding Brass. So that wasn't the bulk of what he did. People tend to think of him in that light.
But good.
He did do some stuff that was specifically apologetic.
Right, and again there he's looking at, here's the general, you know, here's how to write an anti-Mormon manual. It's kind of, he's not only taking on the specific arguments, but it's almost like, yeah, here's how you shape things to lead in these directions, right?
Yeah, I mean, that how to write an anti-Mormon book, that's a classic. That and it's effective because it, you know, but it's so funny.
Yeah.
And so you read it, you remember it, because you remember all, you know, he just lays it out in such a humorous way.
We don't want to forget Nibley's, I thought, really good work on Enoch as well. He would take, what we have there in the Book of Moses, and he wrote a whole book on that called Enoch the Prophet. And so that's another area of study that he spent quite a bit of time on, I would think, delving into.
Yes, he sure did.
And that's kind of a landmark in a way, because remember that appeared as a serial, not in the Improvement Era, but in the M Sign.
And that's right.
Just imagine that today. He had the the reputation or connections or something to get that in print in the M Sign, whereas it's hard to imagine anyone else being able to accomplish that.
Yeah.
What was that called? That was called Strange Thing in the Land. Is that right, Kevin?
Yeah, it's A Strange Thing in the Land, The Return of the Book of Enoch.
Yeah, terrific. Yeah, and I remember, you know, I can't remember the official Hebrew name for the giants that roamed the earth and all that, kind of the flood stuff and these strange passages in Genesis. And he just basically, through his wide reading and the whole ancient world and all the different cultures, not just the Hebrew, Judaic culture stuff, he was able to see motifs and mythic remnants everywhere and sort of tie them together and really help somebody who's looking at those passages and is going, what the heck's going on here? I remember reading some of those and just going, okay, that's cool. Anyway, no need to comment, but or unless that's totally wrong. But I just always found that was like, you know, yeah, if it's some weird thing, Hugh has at least, you know, found five different parallels to it that, you know, can help flesh that out, because, you know, we wanted to know a little bit more, and he was there to provide it, so it's nice. Okay, so those are the areas, basically, and I'm sure maybe things will come up as just memories and you know, things that influence you will do. That's the 10,000-foot view of Hugh's interests. How about this? Brian and Kevin, will have you to alternate on, you know, things in his book. We'll start with the Book of Mormon. Things in his Book of Mormon studies that kind of give people a flavor for the sorts of bits that a lot of current apologetics and ancient, you know, the studies that are going on today in Book of Mormon studies that Hugh sort of started or at least magnified to where they began to get some momentum. So, like, you already mentioned the naming the valleys or something, Brian, you know, as hey, that's just something that the Arabs in that world would do. What's another one?
Another one would be focusing on the names of the Book of Mormon, because the names are transliterated, which means that they're, in some sense, representative of the language that the Nephites would have spoken in their time and place and culture. And so I don't know that a whole lot had been done with that before Hugh, but he did it a little bit more systematically than it had been attempted before. And finding, you know, looking at the, you know, the ancient origins and roots of names, the unique names that appear in the Book of Mormon. And that's a study that has continued, you know, since Hugh. I think there was a whole group of scholars at BYU that focused on, you know, what's called the onomasticon, or the list of proper names in the Book of Mormon. And so Hugh was the one who really kind of got that whole thing started, and then other scholars, you know, picked it up, you know, from him, picked up the baton, and carried it on further.
Great, thank you, Brian. Do you have one?
Well, there were the Jaredites. You know, he's the one that came up with the ideas of the migrations, the Asiatic migrations, and studied those, I think, pretty intensively to come up with some ideas as to population movements that may have been somewhat contemporary with the Jaredites coming over to the New World here. And I remember some of this, you know, I haven't read it for a while, so I couldn't read everything in the last week.
Right.
So, but I recall being quite impressed, you know, with the depth of his understanding of migration patterns and these kinds of things that he studied.
So there's
another one.
He was already way ahead of anything. You know, the DNA stuff kind of caught a lot of people by surprise, but he would, like, there's contemporaries left and right already, so there would have been no surprise there, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Cool. Kevin, you got another one?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is I think in particular in Sins Cumorah, he spent a lot of time talking about the war chapters, like in Alma, analyzing them for military tactics. And there, the fact that he had studied military intelligence in World War II,
right,
he was able to bring that kind of knowledge to bear on the text and to show that the tactics involved are what you would expect, you know, for an ancient battle. So that was something that I found interesting. And again, you know, before Hugh, you read those long chapters in Alma, and it's just boring. And, you know, why would anyone even want to read this? But then once you see it through Hugh's eyes, all of a sudden it's interesting again. And
nice.
So it just helped me gain, you know, an interest in the Book of Mormon where I hadn't had one before.
Excellent. Brian, you ready for another one? Boyd, and you get to jump in whenever you want. I'm just kind of picking these guys' brains.
Well, how about if I throw one out that maybe needed a little correction? Are you up for that?
Okay, please.
Alma 46, with the remnant of Joseph's garment or something like that, that Nibley went into a 10th century Arabic text called Stories of the Prophets by a guy named Thalaby, who I did my dissertation on. He actually talked about how the remnant is in this text, that Thalaby, when Thalaby was talking about Joseph, that there would be a part of his garment that would last for a long, you know, be a remnant. And so I decided, okay, I'm excited about this. I'm going to go back and read. And I actually had a copy of the very text that Nibley used with all his marginalia in there. And so I went through and read through that, and I was a little bit disappointed that that's not what it said.
Oh, the text and, itself. Okay.
Right. The text didn't say that. It actually, the odor of the garment had an effect on people, a magical effect on people, which is very much a common motif that you'll find in this Arabic literature there. And so I wrote up a little bit of a very kind, I thought it was a kind correction in occasional papers. Nobody's perfect. None of us is perfect. I expect my stuff to get corrected as well. And so when I look at Nibley, when I look at all that marginalia, it almost looked like he was speed reading Arabic, classical Arabic there. And I don't know about you, but I can't speed read English very well. And if you're trying to do it in Arabic, that's just a monumental task. I mean, my hat goes off to the guy. He's probably 30, you know, points higher than I am in my IQ anyway. And yet, you know, he had marginalia on every single page of that. It's about a 350, 400 page text of small font Arabic, very dense. And he had read that entire thing. That was pretty impressive. And he was doing it for Book of Mormon. That's what I'm saying. He was doing it so he could kind of come to some understandings about the Book of Mormon. And to me, that's scholarship, you know.
Interesting.
Even if Anyway, just
well, good,
a thought
good.
There.
Yeah, so piece of esoterica that's in the Book of Mormon and seeing what he could find with it, even if it didn't end up ultimately proving out.
Good. Exactly.
Now, I know that the covenant ritual stuff is a big deal. So, in order sort of showing that King Benjamin and that sort of address featured, things that you pretty much would see in the culture of that time and place, at least when the time and place when Lehi and his band would have left Jerusalem. This was certainly some years later, but they would still be going off what they had done earlier. Was that a Nibley discovery, or just did he play with that, or am I remembering wrong that maybe that came out later?
It seems to me that some of that he's doing, especially with King Benjamin, he's doing the ancient New Year rites that kind of spill over from the ancient world. Isn't that right, Kevin? It seems like that's what he's trying
to
do.
Yeah, going back to Cambridge School patternism, everything was an ancient New Year rite in Hugh's eyes. the King Benjamin stuff, I think he did play with that a little bit. But then in the Nibley Festschrift, by study and also by faith, there's an article in there by John Tuetmes where he compares what happened with King Benjamin to the Feast of Tabernacles. And so I think Nibley was probably the kind of the impetus for that, but I think it was other scholars later that kind of fleshed it out more.
Okay, cool. Now, Boyd, you might be able to help here, because I know in your biography, Hugh was involved with the issue of Dialogue in 1973, where Lester Bush did, the major piece on kind of dissembling the blacks and the priesthood ban and all that different stuff. And Hugh was asked to write a companion piece for it. Did he draw on his ancient world stuff as he was this in his Book of Abraham materials? Was remind us what he basically argued, in that piece, and was it tied anything to this Book of Mormon skin color stuff?
You know, that's you caught me off guard there, Dan. I'm sorry, but I haven't read that article for a while, so maybe Kevin and Brian can help me here. But one thing I would notice is that, and I think I brought this up before, is that if there was an area where he came to a different conclusion than kind of the official version of the churches, he would often just not talk about it. And this was one area where, you know, that was the case. I am fairly confident that Nibley saw no reason for the ban on blacks of the priesthood. And he agreed to participate in that dialogue with Lester Bush. Several BYU people backed out. He didn't. I don't remember him really addressing that. So it's been a while since I read that piece. But after the church reversed its policy in his book, Abraham in Egypt, he really comes straight out with dissembling all of that kind of folklore that had piled up to buttress the argument against giving blacks the priesthood. And so, you know, he had a kind of policy that he would not talk about things where he disagreed with the church. And he spent a lot of time talking about things he did agree with. Now, that's in terms of, you know, doctrinal issues. In terms of cultural issues, which we'll get to next time, he definitely came out against Mormon culture. But if he, you know, if a general authority had taken a position on an issue, Hugh very seldom would critique that. I can't think of an example.
Okay, cool. And again, thank you, Boyd. I'm not at all sad that you took us there. Kevin or Brian, was there anything in his study about the Book of Mormon that dealt with the skin color and the cursing? I know that, you know, later we get sense. I know Blake Osler and others have put forth arguments along the lines of, well, of course Nephi and Jacob would look at intermarriage as this huge, you know, taboo, you know, coming out of the, of, you know, 6th century BCE Jerusalem, and, you know, keeping bloodlines and all that stuff there. And so they would use cursed language when they see the children of Laman and Lemuel intermarrying with darker, you know, native folks. And so that's how, you know, the skin color stuff is sort of defanged a little bit there. Was Hugh doing any of that stuff at all?
You know, offhand, I just don't remember, to be honest.
I'm kind of coming up blank, too, on that one.
Okay. All right. I was just curious, because obviously those things would have had to come to his consciousness, and I didn't know the answer ahead of time, so.
You're right about later people and you know, kind of relating this to intermarriage and you know, the taboos of that and culture. And but so much of that is grounded ultimately in Hugh, but it's hard for me to kind of draw those lines, you know. How specific was he, or did he just give hints and other people ran with it? And so,
nice.
So a lot of times in my mind, it all kind of gets mushed together a little bit.
Right, and it would, especially if you know, he didn't have time to do everything, and if truly it was his work that sort of got people excited to look at the things in terms of ancient world, you know, that's it. Like you say, it all roots back to him.
Yeah, I think. It was Elder Maxwell, I think, who made a comment about how Hugh was kind of like an explorer and discovering all these different mine shafts that, you know, were out there that were potential, you know, full of potential. And he would go in a little ways, but it kind of left it for other people to go further. And so, you know, Hugh's scope was so broad, it's really hard to fathom how much he was doing. And some of his arguments, I think, you know, just don't hold up. Like Brian mentioned, I think some of them just, you know, he goofed sometimes. But, you know, he brought this kind of scope, this big picture to the possibilities that other people have really found engaging.
Guys, before we leave the Book of Mormon, how about this? Kevin, do you guys mind going personal for a second? Brian and
sure.
Kevin, especially, and Boyd, if you'd like, what's the particular arguments or areas, these mine shafts that Boyd was just talking about, that Hugh may have explored that really were pivotal for you? Kevin, you kind of mentioned the war stuff making the Book of Mormon interesting to you. Was there anything that really comes together out of Hugh that makes you really hesitant to ever abandon the idea that at least in some form the Book of Mormon is a historical ancient origin document?
I don't know if anything specific. I mean, for me, it's more the kind of the whole panorama of things. You know, it's more of a broad picture than any specific argument.
Okay.
So, I don't know how else to answer that.
Okay.
Well, Nibley had a way of rising above all the issues and giving you the sort of the bird's eye view of things. And that's what really impressed me. He was able to, for instance, like I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, you know, he kind of connects that to more of an Arab desert type approach. And then when it comes over to the New World, he shows how the ancient world kind of folds into that new Nephite civilization that they built in the New World, but yet identifies their own individual, you know, mutations that they do. And so, but yet he's able to look above it and see the patterns and maybe this is going back to Iliade and Jungian type thinking, perhaps he's kind of going on that wavelength there. But I like that. I like the way he's able to do that. So that's what really impressed me. I can't really say that there's anything, you know, like swords or, you know, something like that that kind of really impressed me. Way that he kind of he takes you through the Book of Mormon, I was really impressed with.
Yeah, and just sort of the feel.
I think for me, reading Hugh, it brings me to a consciousness of how superficial my prior reading had been. And it's a consciousness that I retain to this day. So I'm aware that there's always more there. There's always more depth there. And that I often have not taken the time or the effort to find it. So I think that's a big part of it, that I'm skeptical that, you know, if I read something casually and think, oh, well, that doesn't ring right. I have this skepticism that I'm really reading it vigorously enough, because Hugh read it very vigorously, very intently, and brought a lot out. And he kind of modeled that for me. And so I've tried to kind of follow that model in my reading of not only the Book of Mormon, but Scripture generally. And as a result, I've, you know, the Scriptures have become much richer for me than they were when I was in seminary and I was reading just to put the little star on the chart that I finished the book.
Nice.
Terrific. I loved it when I first read his commentary on, for instance, 1 Nephi 1, and how closely he read that and talked about that Nephi's coming from an educated, well-to-do family, this kind of thing, and he's parsing it out and teaching, I think, close reading, just like what Kevin's saying, that we should closely read these things because you're going to pick up some of these nuances. And Nibley was a master at that.
Terrific.
Ancient Studies reading room up at BYU that actually is named after you now. There's a shelf that has, I'm guessing, 15 or 20 copies of the Book of Mormon, those little blue paperback copies that you used to see in the 70s with the angel Moroni on the cover. And each one is marked up just like that Arabic book that Brian mentioned. Just every passage underlined, little nibbly scrawl markings in the margin. I mean, it's really obvious that Hugh read it, like Kevin said, in just this really close way. And I think that's the thing that really resonated with me, is that I became very self-critical of easy interpretations of all Scripture.
And, nice.
And I think that's an important thing to have, you know, this sense that there's something more there that I may not be getting. And I remember one passage that, this doesn't relate to the Book of Mormon, but I think it does indirectly. There's a passage where Hugh was talking about that verse in Genesis that talks about how in the days of Peleg, the continents, people view it as the continents divided, you know.
Right.
Hugh says, you know, this is nonsense, doesn't square with science. And he says, you know, the other way of reading this is that the people divided among, you know, in the land, that the Hebrew works just as well that way. And it gave me this sense that, you know, the shallow reading isn't going to work. nor is a reading that involves kind of cataclysmic events.
Nice.
All with science. But there's often a kind of common sense reading that you just don't know if you don't know the original languages or the culture behind it. And you know, he was so good at doing that time and time again, where he'd bring these ancient cultural traditions and manners and ways that I wasn't aware of that started to make great sense. And I think one of the weaknesses with a lot of critics of the Book of Mormon is that they can understand the book from a 19th century perspective, which is really easy to do because it's not that far back. And a lot of the people who are critical of the Book of Mormon have some study in 19th century culture. But Hugh was immersed in this ancient world. And, you know, I joke, but he couldn't read the newspaper without seeing it through that lens.
Mm.
And so, you know, there was a richness there that really does help me in thinking about scripture in general.
Can I give one more anecdote on that?
Please.
My wife took Pearl of Great Price. So this isn't on the Book of Mormon, but it's in the same topic we're dealing with on close reading. She took a Pearl of Great Price class. We were engaged at the time, and so I just sat in on a couple of them. I had other classes to go to, and I remember him, you know, and his teaching and such. And he started out with Moses chapter 1, verse 1, saying, "And Moses was carried up to an exceedingly high mountain." And I went the first day, and he was talking about that, and I went the second time, and he was talking about that. and then he was going through all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, just all over the world.
Mountains as holy places for Revelation.
Every place you can imagine. And about, I guess, there wasn't a whole lot of the class left, and I hadn't been sitting in on it. My wife said that Nibley said, "Well, you know, I guess we ought to probably hurry it up, or we're not going to get through the rest of the Pearl of Great Price." And he was still on. I'm not kidding. He must have been having some deep study with temples. It must have been his temple time that he was working hard, because by the end of the semester, now this is my wife, she said he had never gotten past that verse.
No way. Wow.
That's what she tells me. And she said, "I really learned at that point that you can get a lot out of one verse." So... Because
that's so awesome.
And I know he didn't do that in every class. I know that didn't happen. But just at this particular time, he must have been immersed in studies about the temple or whatever, and this kind of fit in with what he was doing at that time. And so he spent the semester on it.
Oh, fun stuff. Hey, okay. You guys opened the door. And so how did Hugh handle clear anachronisms when he did find them in the Book of Mormon, or is there things in his, or did he really ever address them, but are there things in his writings or his approach to scripture that have helped you guys handle the anachronisms?
I can't address the specifics, so I'll leave that to Brian and Kevin. So you guys get looking at notes real quick while I talk. But, you know, I think one of the things he did is he often showed that there often is a kind of, shallow way of thinking of something, and then there's often a deeper way, as I just mentioned. And so some of the things, the wordings, little aphorisms, for example, that seem so recent, you know, Hugh would often show that, no, they're actually really pretty old, that Shakespeare was quoting something that was much older than that, you know. So, and I can't think of any specifics here. It's been a while since I read Lehi in the Desert, but you know, he had a way of showing that, you know, even again that 19th century perspective, or even 16th or 17th century, we think, you know, these things seem so anachronistic. Sometimes they really aren't so anachronistic.
Cool. Okay. Good.
I think Hugh didn't necessarily go at anachronisms as directly as someone today might. So, you know, say horses or steel or whatever it is. I mean, today, I mean, someone would just take that topic and talk about it, whereas Hugh would kind of fold it in and just make it part of a broader approach And so I don't remember him being real specific about, oh, this is a purported anachronism, and here's why it's not really an anachronism. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, color by numbers way of doing it that I just don't think he really did very much.
And I think that's kind of where I was at with it too. I do remember him talking about definitions of things, you know, that definitions can be looked at in various ways with various contexts. I don't recall him ever really dealing with the, and maybe Kevin, you can speak to this, the Deutero-Isaiah issue there, whether he ever really gets into that. But I do recall that he would, when he was talking about names and such of animals and those kinds of things, him talking about optional names that could be equated maybe to a horse or something like that. Does that sound about right?
Well, you know what? I'm glad you raised Deutero-Isaiah, because that's actually a perfect example. So Farms published a book called Isaiah and the Book of Mormon, and there's a chapter in that book addressing the question of Deutero or Trito-Isaiah as an anachronism in the Book of Mormon. And this chapter naturally takes the position that Isaiah was, you know, had unified authorship. You know, it was all written by the 8th century BC court prophet, you know, Yeshayahu, Isaiah. Well, Hugh, in his writing, he was actually much more open to kind of the critical view of the Book of Isaiah. But he went on to point out ways that other people had missed or not thought about, that the Book of Mormon actually kind of jibes with this critical approach. For example, Isaiah chapter 1 is not quoted in the Book of Mormon. You know, the famous long passage in 2 Nephi that puts everyone to sleep, it starts with Isaiah chapter 2. Well, to critical scholars, they widely believe that Isaiah 1 was not the original beginning to the book, that it was a later preface, kind of like the preface to the Doctrine and Covenants. It was not chronologically, you know, the first section revealed. And also, you know, the Trito-Isaiah is not quoted in the Book of Mormon. And so Hugh pointed that stuff out, and which for me was very helpful, because it showed that approaching this from a critical perspective is still possible and still useful, rather than just automatically, retreating within your turtle shell and saying, well, Isaiah must have written it all, and that's the only position that works with the Book of Mormon. So that's kind of the difference I was kind of getting at, and, nice. And this Isaiah one is a perfect illustration of that.
Cool. Now, did... You know, the work of Charlie Harrell and stuff now is really focusing on theories of revelation and, you know, the human component and the ancient component, or the revelatory component from God, you know, fully God, fully man, incarnational view of Scripture. Was there anything like that Hugh did that ever would like work on the anachronism issue through something like that, a theory of revelation, and can human beings get the clear, straight scoop? Anybody?
Nothing that's jumping to my mind.
So he wasn't like imagining Joseph Smith in the translation process, you know, pulling from the 19th century context or something the way that a Osler expansionist view might argue.
You know, again, I don't think Hugh's perspective would allow him. I mean, this is not a criticism. This is just I think we all come at Scripture through a lens. And Hugh's lens was the ancient world. And his sharing that with us was a real gift. But, you know, one of the deficiencies in his work, I suppose, is the fact that he didn't have a 19th century lens to look through. I don't think he ever really pointed out or even noticed things that maybe would be considered anachronistic, because his lens was the ancient world. When he read Scripture, it was through that lens. And you know, I think, again, that the evidence he shows of the Book of Mormon being an ancient text is really pretty profound, but problems of how it got here, the translation. None of those things really interested him so much as finding evidence of an ancient world setting in the book itself.
And I would fully agree with that. And again, that's why it just wasn't really computing, because he wasn't really thinking in terms of 19th century. I mean, that just was not the way he looked at it.
Very good. Thanks for weighing in and indulging there. How about this for next? Let's do the Egyptian endowment, you know, Book of Abraham kind of stuff, as just sort of in the same way they did the Book of Mormon. And then after that, we'll kind of just talk about, you know, shotgun any of the other areas. But what would be the major claims that Hugh did to sort of, well, where did he come down on the actual translation of, you know, a record of Abraham versus, you know, and because the papyri came out obviously during Hugh's lifetime, and it was shown to be the Book of Breathings and all that different stuff. How did Hugh handle that and yet still sort of have an affirmative, this is genuine revelation, this still had a real connection to Abraham? Does anyone able to articulate that stance he took?
I kind of feel sorry for Hugh a little bit, because, you know, when all that stuff hit, he was on an island. I mean, he was the only person in the church that had the chops at all to deal responsibly with it. We've got guys in the religion department at BYU who are writing books about it, but they're talking about the history because they you know, they don't control the languages or anything like that. And so Hugh is kind of on his own a little bit, and that was a lot of pressure. You know, he's got the weight of the church on his shoulders. And so I admire him for taking that on, but I also kind of feel a little bit bad for him. I mean, that's a terrible position to put someone in.
Well, can I just add that when the papyri was given back to the church in the mid-60s there, Kevin's absolutely right. There wasn't anybody at that time. And kind of put yourself in the position of President Tanner or somebody like that, who's looking at these documents. It's first, second century Herodic Egyptian, you know, and they don't have a clue. So it made perfectly good sense for them to go, well, can we get Hugh Nibley in here, please? You know, can we have him look at this stuff and tell us what's going on with this material? And because he was really the only one at that time that could do it. And I don't remember exactly when Klaus Baer comes in. Was it after? Maybe Boyd can answer that.
I think part of the problem here is that he's taking that sabbatical in 1966 or 67. The papyri are discovered, and we'll put that in quotes because there's actually they were allowed to be discovered in spring of 66. So Hugh had a little training in Egyptian. He had started a more intensive training in Egyptian when they come out. And all of a sudden, as Kevin says, he's put in this position of having to defend the church. And, you know, he really, let's be honest, he wasn't equipped to really do it. And so for a long time, he stalled. And a lot of his early work there was just kind of summarizing what other people have said about the Book of Abraham and dealing with their arguments. And I don't think he would be ashamed to say he was stalling. He really didn't have the language skills yet to respond.
And well, he not only wouldn't be ashamed of it, he actually said it himself.
Yeah.
He said
he's
frankly skirmishing for time.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't think, you know, it was a tough position. Now, I want to make one other comment about that. Is I don't think he flinched, though. I don't think this created any kind of psychic, you know, tension that he ended up, you know, to go back to our previous conversation, that he ended up, you know, having some kind of psychological break that caused him to molest his daughter. That's what Martha claimed, and I think it's absurd. He was in very vigorous health at the time. His mental skills were fine. He freely admitted he was skirmishing. that he was stalling, and he did his best. But his early arguments, I think, ended up being weak. And when he was challenged later, Ed Ashmont in a Sunstone symposium asked Hugh to respond to a paper that he didn't give him in advance. So Hugh had no fair warning for this section where he was criticizing Hugh's argument. And so he kind of jumped this on him. And in the Sunstone symposium, Hugh was responding to this where Ashmont really took apart his argument. And Hugh's response to that was, bring it on. You know, that's the way scholarship works. If there's a newer argument or a newer way of looking at it, we have to deal with it. Don't hold me responsible, he said, for something I said 5 years ago.
Nice.
So I think it's important to remember that Hugh, when he engaged in scholarship, he knew the game he was playing, and he knew that some of his arguments would hold up, some of them wouldn't, and that's just the way that profession works.
Yeah.
Can I just say that it's interesting that maybe at the beginning there, he was trying to understand he's learning Egyptian from Klaus Baer and those kinds of things, but then when he comes out with his book on the Egyptian endowment, he's done what a scholar should do. He found a parallel text in Louvre 3284. He was able to go through and study those texts and come up with a reasonable translation. And so he put it through the scholarly works, just as a scholar should. And you got to tip your hat to the man. He's probably in his 60s at the time, learning Egyptian and doing this kind of research still. Again, a testament to the intellect and the brilliancy of the man, in my view. I'm almost to that point in my age, and I couldn't pick up a new language now if you threw it at me, I don't think. So I think there's something to be said for that.
He had some exposure to Egyptian and Coptic even before he went to this year in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I think just his... He had studied so many languages so vigorously for so long that if anyone could make headway on a new-ish language at that age, I think it would be Hugh, and it was. He did make good headway, and it's an impressive accomplishment.
Now, what did he end up arguing? What was his major conclusions once he got through the initial shock and the learning curve and things like that? So you mentioned the message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, an Egyptian endowment, as this major work and certainly a highly sought after book and things like that. Where did he end up landing?
Well, in message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, his basic argument was that the Sen-Sen Papyrus was not the source for the Book of Abraham. And he based that on a description that Oliver Cowdery had given of the papyri, which Hugh took to be the source of the Book of Abraham, in which Oliver Cowdery clearly describes some parts written in red ink. And that's a phenomenon well known to Egyptologists. That's called rubrics. And Hugh rightly said that the Sen-Sen papyrus did not have any rubrics. And so he said, okay, so we know that the Sen-Sen Papyrus was not the putative source or perceived to be the source of the Book of Abraham. So we can put that whole thing aside. But now let's look at it, and, you know, we're going to do this very lengthy, careful commentary on it. And ultimately, in that book, you see he's kind of comparing the Sen-Sen Papyrus to what we know as the endowment. Now, personally, I think his argument was wrong, because that statement from Oliver Cowdery, to me, is clearly a description of the entire Joseph Smith collection, not specifically of the source of the Book of Abraham. And the entire Joseph Smith collection has fragments from a couple of different copies of the Book of the Dead, which clearly do have rubrics. So... I disagree with that argument that he made, but that was the way he looked at it.
Okay. And so it's still one of the lines of argument that are being put forth today, though, right, about the Book of Abraham?
We call that the missing papyrus theory.
Okay.
That the Book of Abraham was not related to the Sen-Sen papyrus, but to some other papyrus in Joseph's possession that was later destroyed in the Chicago fire.
Okay.
And he had to buttress that with that argument with his meaning of the Kirtland Egyptian papers as well. He was the first one to really delve into those papers and to study those documents, the Abraham ones, as well as the Egyptian grammar and alphabet papers. And he actually, in that article, buttressed that argument that the source of the Book of Abraham was not the papyri.
Okay. Is there anything that you guys would want to say about Hugh's work on the Book of Abraham that you haven't said?
Well, just that it was prolific. I mean, if you did a page count of not only the books, but the serial, the serial article in the Improvement Era, and then all of the separate articles, standalone articles, many of them in BYU Studies, his output during that time on this subject was huge. And he was just churning stuff left and right. So he was very, very committed to this topic at that time.
And I think he was at his apologetic. I mean, he was in his apologetic mode there. He was defending the church with most of his Book of Abraham stuff. That's what the way I kind of read his material as I'm going through the Book of Abraham studies that I'm doing right now. And as brilliant as he was, it was highly defense. He was in a very much a defense mode on that because it's a tough issue. There's no question about that.
So what has stuck from him that's still in play today with some sort of street cred?
Well, there was so much that he published that, there's all kinds of details that you have to look at. Some of it has stuck, certainly. But most people are interested in the really broad point of, did people think that the Sen-Sen papyrus was the source for the Book of Abraham. And, personally, I disagree with where he went with that. But then he went ahead and he analyzed and did a lengthy commentary on the Sen-Sen papyrus. And, Klaus Bayer was, very complimentary towards a lot of his work. Even acknowledging his limitations as not a fully trained Egyptologist, still, he wasn't a fully trained Egyptologist, but his facility with the language had improved. But he was a generalist in ancient history, with tremendous abilities generally. And so he had an advantage there that an Egyptologist that is just focused on Egypt would not have had. And so even today, if you really want to look at those texts, you can't just push Nibley to the side and say, well, this is all irrelevant now. You still have to take account. You still have to read all that and take Nibley into account. So he is not, irrelevant now by any means.
Okay, thank you.
No, not at all. I would agree with that, Kevin. And if I can just say that the Book of Abraham work that he did was, there are still some things that have stuck. Remember, he looked at things through those ancient lens. And so if you've got Pharaoh dressed in woman's clothes, well, he's going to deal with that. He's going to go back into the ancient world. He's going to see, is that what happened back in those days? He's gonna ask those kinds of questions and see if there were some things like that going on. And those kinds of things have stuck. And I still hear those. As far as what's, from Nibley's work, okay, it's generated. I don't know if Nibley himself came up with the missing papyri directly. I think that's been more John Gee, where he's really argued that point. much more than Nibley ever did. But it is rooted in Nibley. There's no question about it. A lot of the apologetics that goes on today with Book of Abraham, at least the Farms apologetics, is rooted in Nibley. And you can kind of just trace it right back to where Nibley's written something about that.
Thanks, you guys. And you're helping, I think, really put Hugh in context here with this kind of work and where it's at today, and it's still obviously in flux. There is the one, there's the direct critiques that a lot of people have basically had of Hugh's interpretation and some of the work that he's done with the facsimiles. And I know that the book One Eternal Round came up out after he died. It had been the last thing that he'd been working on and things like that. But what is there to say to frame in terms of his work on the three facsimiles?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment on the book One Eternal Round, which he had worked on in fits and starts, with different approaches. Like, sometimes it would be the dialogue approach that he used sometimes in his Improvement Era series on the property. And then other times he would use a different approach. And he had all kinds of different drafts. And so when representatives from Farms came to his house to take his material, when he finally just could not work on it anymore, they had to treat it like an archaeological dig because there were piles of papers, and so they had to record where these piles came from,
and
they were trying to help
data files
recreate. I'm sorry,
there were multiple data files his secretary had saved. Each iteration of the drafts on the computer. And so not only did they have the archaeological paper project, they had the data project. And he had been working on this for 10 years. So it was a monumental task to put that together.
I had talked to Mike Rhodes about this, and Mike told me that there were some chapters that there were anywhere up to a dozen iterations of that chapter. And that Mike was in the position to try and figure out, well, what would Nibley want there? What does he want me to say here?
Wow.
Yeah, it was a difficult process. And in fact, the day before he passed away, we had a meeting. I remember that this because it was my birthday. He passed away the day after my birthday. So it was February 23rd. We had a meeting at his house in his living room. Several representatives of Farms to try to figure out what we were going to do with this last book. He had, as Kevin said, just given up on it. He felt like he could not finish it. But representatives of Farms, later called the Maxwell Institute, and the family felt like, if something didn't come out, it would look like, he was stymied in this effort. And I don't think he ever was. He always was searching for the right way to get that approach in, and I think he just finally, his body wore out before he could finish it. In terms of what remains of the Book of Abraham stuff, again, Brian mentioned several things that I think stand up intellectually. One of the things I really love about Egyptian endowment and his work on the facsimiles is, and again, this may be passé scholarly-wise, but for me personally in my spiritual life, it's meant a great deal. And that is this pattern of sacrifice, the tour of the cosmos that he talks about in terms of the facsimiles, and then final exaltation and seating on the throne. The pattern of those facsimiles, whether Joseph Smith knew what he was doing or not, there's a pattern there that is really beautiful, and it appeals to my soul, and it speaks to me. And so, again, I'm not an Egyptologist. I don't even know the ancient world very well. I have enough Hebrew to be dangerous. So I can't speak to those bigger issues. But in terms of the pattern, in terms of, what it means to me personally, I think Nibley, again, this kind of goes to that mystical side of him. I think he saw something there that speaks to some really deep spiritual truths. And so that, I think, is the thing that I would find that's still left after all this other stuff is gone. Nibley saw the meaning of covenants, the meaning of temple endowments, the whole scope and vision of that that pattern of you know, making those covenants and ultimate exaltation. I think he really had an inspiring way of viewing that stuff. So it still means a great deal to me.
Well, I let me give you one specific example, a very small example of something like that really resonated with me. In Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, he had a picture of two Egyptians in a ritual embrace. And he didn't really draw the connection. He trusted the reader to draw the connection in his own mind, which is what I did. But it put what happens at the veil in the temple in a whole different meaning for me. And it all of a sudden made that little bit of ritual that I had never thought about before come alive. This is one small thing in this book, but it just resonated with me. And it made, you know, something in the temple a lot more meaningful for me. And it has to this day. I still think of that based on kind of the insight that Hugh brought to it through his Egyptian work.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.